supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I would say I definitely owe my mother a phone call. I'm overdue.
Call your mom. From WHYY and First Person Arts in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, and I'm your host, Jamie J. Here on Common Space, live storytelling connects us to each other and the world. And I'll take you a little bit deeper into the stories with conversations that just might challenge your perceptions. And seriously, call her. She birthed you, cleaned you up, and fed you long before you could do it for yourself. Taught you to walk and talk, and had an unquantifiable influence on the person you are today. On this episode of Common Space, we bring you one daughter's story of a mother who went above and beyond even all that. But first, we wanted to hear from you about the role your mom plays in your life. So we had Common Space associate producer Allie L'Esperance ask around at a recent First Person Arts event.
My first thought was, what don't I owe my mother? Really, I mean.
Off the top of my head, I would say that I owe her my sense of responsibility. My parents are divorced, and my dad was very lax, more of a friend, and my mom was very strict, which was annoying throughout high school and for most of my childhood life. But in hindsight, it was very important and has done me a lot of good. So thank you, Mom. I received that message.
I owe her a very deep approval and appreciation of all the different facets of like a woman's power coming through at a very young age. When I was growing up, I would start to get that little bit of like edge. And instead of shutting down the little girl who starts to spout her mouth off, my mother and her sisters would just go, oh, tell me. And my mother taught me how to belly dance too. And so she'd like tell me, she'd be like, shake your hips for me. And I'd be like so angry. And she'd be like, shake your hips, show me. And it was just this really deep approval for just like natural bodies and being like a flesh and blood woman.
Well, other than the fact that I'm here, I would say that, you know, I kind of a sense of self. She was good at instilling a sense of self. She allowed me to make mistakes and kind of go out and not overprotect or things like that, but gave me the freedom to do what I needed to do in order to find myself.
I owe her everything. I mean, she raised me, she loved me, like she's my best friend, so everything.
So again, the general consensus is we owe our moms everything. Sometimes those things are seemingly trivial, other times monumental and crucial. But imagine, if you will, that your entire life rests on a journey your parents took to escape danger and genocidal violence in their home country, just to get here. Such an immigrant story is what brought Sok B from Cambodia to America. She spoke with Common Space executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna.
Tell me about your mother.
My mother is a strong, powerful woman who's carried on her shoulders our family all of her life. Her mother was a strong, beautiful, smart, powerful woman who was also carrying her family on her shoulders. My mother was the eldest of six children and came from a family that was poor, where my grandfather had his own weaknesses and left it to my grandmother to figure out how to survive in Cambodia, in a small city where everybody knows each other, where my grandfather was getting into gambling debts and would leave the house and leave the family for periods of time and then leave it to my grandmother to figure out how to pay those debts and then leave it to my mother then and her siblings on how to then survive on not having a man in the house to bring in the income. And said, well, we can't depend on him, so we have to come together and figure out how to pay off his debts, keep our family together, and continue forward. And so that really created for them and through her a really strong bond. And with that, she carried us through a war, through coming to America, through creating a business. So she and my father have operated a business for over 30 years, put my brother and myself through college. So yeah, my mom's a strong, strong woman.
You know, you often hear that, the strength of my mother, and she was resilient. But what does it really mean on a day-to-day thing? What are some examples?
Well, you have to make sacrifices, right? I think about the sacrifices that I've had to witness. I mean, there's the material things. You don't buy new clothes. You don't buy new cars. You don't move into a bigger house when you can afford it. There's also that when you have some, you give it away. That even though you gain a little, that you have to think about this greater good. This is how I felt it. I wasn't always number one. And that was something that I had to come to terms with because my mother put the family and the greater good of the family ahead of not her relationship with me, because everything that she did for the family was because of me. But the journey that she took to show her love and her value towards us was not about putting me as an individual first, but really about putting the greater good of our family first. So I didn't get a new car. I didn't get a new toy. But that's because we then took that money and gave it to our cousins who were in Cambodia who needed that money more than I needed that toy. And when I say needed it, it's because somebody had a medical emergency, like my aunt got diagnosed with cancer in Cambodia. And in Cambodia, there's not insurance or anything like that. And so you have to pay cash in order to go to the hospital. And so it comes from out of what would have been spent for us. So you'll hear at the dinner table who we're helping, who's in need right now. How much money do we have to send over there to get them the kind of care that they need so that they'll survive?
What are the stories you hear about war?
I was only 3 or 4 years old when I came. So the stories I hear are secondhand stories. And what's interesting about the life that we have now is that family gatherings for us are a really important time to pull everybody together. It was also the time then where, because everybody was getting together, where they could talk about what happened in the past. I'm thinking about the kind of luck that we had as a family. Let me say that in the war of Cambodia, a lot of people lost family members. We had friends and family who, we call them uncles now, but who, they were the only living survivor of that family unit. Every single person in that family, the six, her four brothers and my aunt, we survived.
Your parents went to a refugee camp, you know that. But it was impossible to be during the war and the Pol Pot and all that without seeing some ugly levels of violence and mayhem. Did they ever speak to you about it, or they say that's not something you need to know?
They did, but only when pressed. And in fact, recently I had this memory, and I asked my mom about it. We were just talking, and I said, "Mom, can you let me know if it was true or not?" I said, "I have this dream that we were walking and you were holding me and you were holding me close to your chest, but that you were crying and that there were people carrying, it looked like bodies," is what I said to her. And I was like, "I don't know, like I can't imagine like when this would happen, like where would I have been at that time? And do you have any history for me on that?" And she said, "Actually, probably when you were around 1 or 2 years old, this was during the war, we had to walk through a field of dead bodies. We were walking on this trail, and as you know, in Cambodia, they put landmines everywhere. And so we were walking in single file, and every once in a while, you would hear bombs go off, and somewhere far ahead of us, a mine would go off, and it would detonate, and it would kill people. You would have to walk over these bodies as we're making this journey. And so we tried to shelter you children from that. But you could smell the burning carcass. You could also imagine that this is in Cambodia where it's hot, where the sun is beating on you. There's no shade. It's not only that the bodies have exploded and that they're dead and there's blood everywhere, but that it's rotting, it's decaying." And she said, "Yeah, that was a real memory."
I think you say, you tell the story that you remember, that you had like a bunch of people on a bike your escape of Khmer Rouge.
So this is our escape from the Khmer Rouge to the Thai border and eventually to the refugee camp on the Thai side. So at that time, the only way to kind of see that hope, to think about another day, is to think about escape. To think about escaping this place where you're being asked to work all the time, where your family is being threatened by the Khmer Rouge, where every night you go to bed, you don't know if you're going to wake up or if somebody's going to come and pull you out of your house and kill you or pull family members from their homes and kill them. So my mother and father made a plan to run to the Thai border where they knew that there was a refugee camp where they would be saved. The only way that they could get there, though, was by a bike. It was too far to walk. And so my father loaded this bike with my mother, holding my infant brother, myself on the middle bar, and him riding us through Cambodia, basically, from the city to the Thai border. And as I understand the story, we actually had to do this trip twice. So the first time we did this, we had gotten to the border. But when we arrived, they had closed the border. And so we weren't able to make that escape. And what's scary about that is if the Khmer Rouge had caught you, you would have been shot on the spot. And so when we saw that the border was closed, we were able to divert and go back to the place where we were. The second time, we actually were able to make it through. Yeah.
So how did they get here?
We were part of, I believe it was a Lutheran Social Services that did resettlements through the UN. And so we were resettled. In fact, my grandmother and her children were resettled in America first. They were sent to Detroit, Michigan. And then because when we were in the refugee camps in Thailand and the UN had asked as part of their application, do you have family in America? We were able to say, yes, we have family in Detroit, Michigan. And that's how we were then brought here. So there's a lot to be said about America and the services that we offer, and being able to help people out of harm's way, I think, is something that I really am grateful for.
You know, one of the things that happen a lot with sons and daughters of refugees and immigrants is that they have to negotiate that balance of keeping the traditions and then understand their new nation and the needs of a new country there. It's hard for people to understand that you living in those two worlds, it's never that easy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first thing I remember was one day I had invited a friend over for dinner, which it's uncommon for my family. We just never did that. And people were arranging play dates and whatnot. We would see like, oh, so-and-so got invited to somebody's house for dinner. And I said, Mom, can I invite somebody home for dinner? She's like, okay, you can try, but we won't be there. You guys will have to take care of dinner on your own. And so we invited a friend over and we had rice, which is typical Cambodian Chinese. We have rice at every meal. And I was thinking about, what are we going to serve this person, this American friend, for dinner? And so we cut up hot dogs because that's very American. And we served it with rice. And the person was like, oh, this is interesting. And then they asked, well, can I have butter with this rice? And all of us just sat there and we just looked at this person like shocked. Who puts butter on rice? Like, if you're going to put anything on rice, you're going to put soy sauce on rice. I mean, that's just a small example. I think there's also that kind of deeper values, kind of like the choice to go away to school or to stay at home, right? As a daughter, I should have stayed at home and been close to my family. But instead, I chose to go away to school. And not only that, I eventually moved to China for 2 years, very far separated from my family. And these are negotiations between what do I value as an independent person, as a strong, free-thinking person growing up in America as an independent woman. And then this kind of tug with tradition where my mom says, as my daughter, you must stay close to me, not mentally, not emotionally, but physically. I need you living in the same house as me. You cannot be far away from me.
Ooh.
So imagine that clash, right? And this is me. I'm like 18. so there's that riff, right? And there's that tension. And there were times where we weren't speaking for months on end because I was trying to find out who I was as an American, as a Chinese American, as a Chinese Cambodian American, as a woman.
Your grandmother was not with you when you came.
No, but we eventually lived with each other. So imagine this house in Michigan with three generations, grandparents, parents, and children. And not only that, but there's another house next door to it where my aunt bought her house. So it was a little corner house or two houses on a corner with a fence. We took down the fence between the two houses. So the only time I was apart from my cousins is when we went to bed. And so it was like my grandmother, my grandfather, my mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle. I mean, at some point, there must have been like 25 people, just Chinese people, Asian people. And we were the only Asians in the community. So just, you know, oh, yeah, it's that clan right there.
Did you feel like a clan?
Not until after I had perspective on it. Because what I didn't know then was that this is not what other people did. This was not normal. For me, it was normal to be ensconced in a family unit. It was normal to have your aunts and uncles around you. It was normal to have your grandmother telling you what to do. It was normal to have your grandmother cooking for you every day. It was normal to have your mother working at a restaurant. It was normal to kind of just be part of this unit and not normal to be searching for your own story, that you were kind of protected in this nest that they created for us.
Well, at the same time, you felt you needed to leave to find yourself there. Mm-hmm. Did your mother speak to you ever, or did you, about her process of becoming, understanding what an American woman or an American mother is supposed to do or does? Or
yeah,
you're laughing, you're smiling.
Because she started going to therapy, which I have to say... And she used this therapy as an excuse to kind of manipulate me. She said, well, now I go to therapy, and this is what the therapist told me. And she tried to use that as an influence. As she said that you should be on this part of your development path. But anyway, so yes, my mom did start thinking about her own journey, not just to America, but her own journey as a person. I don't think she realized in the time that she was here, that she had her own journey to be on. And it took us until very recently, probably in the past 2 years, and so this is about 30 years later, to say like, oh, I have something to contribute. That's not about my family, but that's about me. That's about my own story as a daughter of a very strong woman, as a daughter of a refugee, but as a person who came to America as an immigrant.
Are you a parent yourself?
I am not.
Okay. But what are the things if you have children? Mm-hmm. They say, I'll never do this to my kids, or on the reverse, I'll teach them to understand traditions on both sides. Or how would you see parenthood?
I have nieces and nephews. And not having children of my own, I think it's for me to make sure that I'm the aunt who actually holds the family identity for our family. Because my cousins, my brother, they're busy parenting. I think the one thing that I want to make sure is to make explicit that our story is unique and that where we've come from also determines where we'll go.
How do they see that, knowing that around they're surrounded by people who either don't understand immigrant experience or heritage?
Well, that's a struggle that we all have, and that has to do with our own search for our own identity. My brother has married a Caucasian woman, and his daughter is half Chinese, half German, Polish, American. So she has many identities to draw from. My cousin married a Vietnamese, Chinese. So there's going to be a search for identity across all of these identities, across all of these countries. I don't know how anybody's going to navigate that. I know I had my own journey. And the funny story is that I actually found myself drawn most closely to African-American culture because growing up in America and growing up in the suburbs of Detroit in a very Caucasian white neighborhood, the only other that I could find to identify in literature and popular culture and media was the African-American community. And so I was reading Malcolm X. I was reading Martin Luther King. I was reading Maya Angelou. And so I found then that creating a sense of culture and identity in that community led people to say, like, who are you to be in our community, to be identifying with this? And also led my mom to say, like, where are you? Who are you hanging out with? I think one day my uncle was looking at my Facebook page and he said, how come all of your friends are black? And I was like, oh, that's because that's who I identify with right now. That's changed. I have a bigger variety of friends now.
And was your mother curious about why?
The things that drove my mother were not questions about me per se and my interests. The things that drove my mother about me were, what was I accomplishing? What was I doing? And this was my perception, so I don't know that this is true. But what was I doing that she could then tell her friends about who her daughter was? And so sometimes she would ask, what are you studying in school? Only sometimes. Because when I told her I was studying sociology, she says, I don't understand that. Can you tell me what else you're studying so that I can make it understandable for my friends? She was really happy when I went to law school because then she could say, oh, my daughter's a lawyer. The problem was then after I left law school, I didn't practice as a lawyer. I started doing other work. And she said, I can't tell my friends that you're a lawyer anymore because I don't even understand what you're doing. When I said I was in fundraising, she's like, I don't know what that means. So I'm just going to tell them you're a lawyer. So
are you a good daughter?
I think I'm a great daughter. I'm a fantastic daughter because I now know that my mother is a person. I know that sounds odd, but like I think, and this is probably natural in our evolution as daughters to mothers and children to parents, I finally see my mom as an individual and as an incomplete person, as a person on her own journey who also struggles with her own identity here in America and her own legacy for her family. So yeah, I'm a great daughter, but it's only because I come from a great mother.
Sok Bi and her family came to the U.S. as refugees from Cambodia in 1980. Sok currently lives in Philadelphia, where she is the director of grants for the American Friends Service Committee. She spoke with Common Space executive producer Elizabeth Perez Luna. It's a funny thing that perhaps our greatest fear as women and our mother's fondest hope is that we will become just like them when we grow up. So Common Space associate producer Ali L'Esperance asked participants at a recent First Person Arts event, what were the biggest things you took from your mother that made you who you are today?
Let emotions subside before you decide.
To not hide who you are, really. Just tell it like it is, and whatever happens, happens.
Probably her work ethic, because we both are very hard workers and very committed to what we do.
I would say her sense of curiosity, number one thing.
My damaged liver. She is a queen of Whiskey Wednesdays, Tequila Tuesdays, Thirsty Thursdays, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Only break is on Monday. She's the best.
Cheers. This is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J. Listen to Common Space every Sunday night at 8 p.m. and subscribe to us anytime at Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Our Common Space team includes executive producer and co-writer Elizabeth Perez Luna, producer Mike Villers, associate producers Ali L'Esperance and Jen Cleary, Dan Gashevsky and Tanisha Ford from First Person Arts, and archivist Neil Barden. Our engineer was Charlie Kyer, and our theme music is by Subglow. On behalf of my mom, Barbara, and Elizabeth Perez-Luna's mom, Natasha, thanks for listening.